Was it you that would be England's king? Was you that revelled in our parliament and made a preachment of your high descent?
This is the inimitable Tina Packer, founding artistic director of Shakespeare and Company in Lenox, Massachusetts. And here she stepped into the role of Queen Margaret in Shakespeare's Henry VI, Part 3.
It is a fault too unpardonable. Off with the crown. And with the crown, his head. And whilst we breathe, take time to do him dead.
Margaret, determined, a warrior, violent even, the woman who beheads the Duke of York at the climax of her famous Molehill speech. Queen Margaret. As Tina Packer puts it, Queen Margaret is a part of Shakespeare's soul, a step in his spiritual journey as an artist and human being, which is reflected in the development of his female characters, from the broken, cowed Kate in The Taming of the Shrew all the way to, believe it or not, Juliet. Star-crossed though she may be, by Tina Packer's lights, Juliet has an understanding of life equal to that of men. And Tina Packer writes about the bard's feminist evolution, if I can call it that, in her book, Women of Will, Following the Feminine in Shakespeare's Plays. And Tina Packer joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
It's a delight to have you here. Before we sort of dive into the thesis that's in the book, I have to ask you, you mentioned that Margaret was the first woman in the canon that you really passionately wanted to play.
Yes.
Why is that?
Well, and listening to it just now, I think, oh, God, she's a real killer. Do you know, I actually do think it had something to do with that. I think I was brought up in, a very quiet suburb of Nottingham. My parents sent me to a Quaker school when I was 11. I got a scholarship there. And I had this killer instinct in me that kept on wanting to come out. And through Margaret, I got into the Royal Shakespeare Company, but also through expressing her, I knew how violent I could be, and I also knew that I would never go there. But I needed to express it before I could get that kind of knowledge about myself and then think that I will not do that. I know the path to that. I'm not going to ever do that.
So Margaret is a character in one of the history plays.
Yes.
Where does she fall then in this evolution, which we'll talk about a little bit more, in Shakespeare's attitude about women?
She's right at the beginning, except she's in four plays, you see. Nobody else is. Richard III is in three plays, but nobody else is in as many plays as she is. So I think what happens is when you see her first, she's this young virginal thing, and then she starts taking over Shakespeare's imagination. But she's a virago. She is not going to be put down. And although there's glimpses of real humanity in her, which means that Shakespeare's seeing this, she's right at the beginning. She's right at, you know, women are either have to be tamed because they're shrews, they're horrible, or they're sweet little things that sit on the pedestal and don't say boo to a goose. You know, I used to have to play a lot of those when I was younger as well. But I knew I didn't want to be one of them.
Well, you use the word tame, of
yes,
course.
Yes.
So one of the very first women then would be Kate,
yes,
as we mentioned,
absolutely,
in Taming of the Shrew.
Yeah.
Now, do we know how old Shakespeare is when he writes the character?
23.
Okay.
We think around there. So
he's got a frat boy sensibility, Kate.
You can say that. You know, and the fact that the Petruchio thinks the way to tame her is to starve her, to take away her clothes, to not let her say what she wants to say. I mean, those are torture processes, you know, and it's however every conqueror takes away the people he is conquering. And so that's why I think by the end of Taming of the Shrew, Kate has been done in and she's psychologically changed and not for the better. But of course, in that day, and I'm sure Shakespeare thought this too, it was a very happy marriage. And that's why he had to change in order to be the playwright that he is.
Oh, had to change.
He had to change. He would never have ended up as the playwright he is if he'd kept on projecting on women like that.
Okay.
So it was when he suddenly started realizing women are whole human beings just like men are, and that their value is equal to men's, if not more equal, but is equal to men's, that made a profound difference to him.
Well, let's take a step back here, and just for sort of the sake of setting some more context.
Yes.
How many men? You've done the counting.
Yes.
How many male characters are there in the canon?
There's way over 1,000.
And how many female?
150, 160. So it depends on whether you think fairies are male or female, you know, and all that kind of stuff.
Depends on the day of the mood, I guess. So roughly a 1-to-10 ratio.
Yes, it's quite surprising.
Now, then how would you describe, when you took the time, and you took quite a bit of time,
a lot of time,
explore this evolution, you call it an evolution of Shakespeare's own soul that we see on the page, through his female characters, what is he evolving towards?
He's evolving towards how can we stop the picture of the world that is so violent. I mean, just listening to your last segment, how can we stop, you know, making people violent? And what is it, how can we look at a society? What are the ingredients that are needed in order for us to behave more humanely towards each other so that we actually invigorate and enlighten each other's souls? And that as a country, we do that, not just only within the family structure or within lovers, but with all of us.
Can I just say, I'm so sorry to interrupt, but this is so fascinating to me because I take your point about wanting the world to be less violent, and yet so many of his female characters, at least, you know, it seems to me early on, are the instruments of violence.
And later on as well, with Lady Macbeth and Volumnia and the eldest daughters of Lear. Yes, no, it's only right in the very last cycle of his writing life when he changes and starts writing myths or fairy tales that he says, I'm trying to find the map through this. So no violence, of course, violence is the heart of drama in so many ways, but he was not ignorant about what it is that he feels that women are capable of doing. And we are. You know, we are. That's what I found out when I played Margaret. Mm. I was capable of that. But it was a long journey for him. And I think, you know, the real shift begins with Juliet. And why was it he shifted so profoundly? What made him stop projecting on women and start writing from the inside of women as if he was a woman? And I think it's because he fell in love with somebody deeply, profoundly, sexually and spiritually.
Can we talk a little bit more about Juliet Tina Packer? Because I'm ashamed I'm about to say this, but I think I'm still traumatized from having to read Romeo and Juliet in ninth grade. And I can't get past the star-crossed lover. Did this for Romeo, ended up taking her own life. You know, she didn't strike me as the empowered young lady that I wished she had been.
That's not true. She is. She said, if thy bent of love be honorable, thy purpose, marriage, send me word tomorrow. So she actually proposes to him. She says, my bounty is as boundless as the sea, my love as deep. The more I give to thee, the more I have, for both are infinite. So she actually taps into love being infinite, and that it's boundless. And if you fall in love with somebody, it opens up the whole world. She says that. He then follows suit, but she's the one, although he does say, it is my soul that calls upon my name. But she, once she falls in love, just look, she's when she hears he's killed her cousin, she struggles between hating him and loving him. And in the end, she chooses to love Romeo, not hate him for killing her cousin. When she discovers that she's going to be forced to marry somebody else, she takes poison that could kill her. And when in fact she's too late, when she wakes up from the poisonous sleep and sees that he's dead, she thinks, I'd rather be in death with him than, now that's pretty brave. believe. Mm. Somebody who can kill themselves in order to have the idea of being with the beloved. You know, in Antony and Cleopatra, they give you a clearer idea of what the afterlife is, so you can see why they kill each themselves to be with the other. But in Romeo and Juliet, she doesn't know. It's instinct.
So no offense to my ninth grade literature teacher, but I wish you had been teaching
well,
me.
Well, I'm sorry. That's one of the things, you know, and one of the things we do at Shakespeare and Company, which is the company I founded, is that we are in the schools all the time directing the kids in the plays so that they can have the experience of this.
So towards the end, the later plays in the canon, or at least the ones that we believe are the later plays, what do we see in Shakespeare's female characters?
Well, I just want to go to the middle things where the women start taking on the truth about they start being the brave people who say, wait a minute, this society is unjust, unfair, duplicitous. If they stay in their frocks, they're killed or they run mad. If they say what they think and they're truthful and they stay and they disguise themselves as men, then they can organize everybody. Once he's gone through that, that women actually can change things, providing they're dressed as men, he then goes into the darkest period, which is where the women dominate and cause fascism in the country, if I can put it like that, until he comes into the late plays. And what he says in the late plays is that you need at least one woman, but preferably two or three women, to put right the huge sin that has happened at the top of the play, and that they redeem their fathers. But you also need something else too, which is the creative spirit. Uh-huh. That unless you can change the way we think, unless you can get out of linear thinking, revenge thinking, I mean, it just, you know, unless you can actually shift this idea of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, but you really can shift it and say, I will not be the same as the person who has perpetrated these horrors upon me. And that needs creative thinking and love.
In the book, you write, as you were watching a performance of The Tempest, you say, this is the Shakespeare who wrote at the end of his life. He found a way to make the world come into harmony, make it come all right, not simply right, but complexly right.
Yes. I mean, because life is complex and you can have profound desires to kill somebody else or to avenge yourself in some way. But then there's an other voice that speaks to you and says, don't do this. You know, go to some other place. And that's that complexity of being able to hold two or three or four feelings at the same time and then choose the one that's actually going to bring life, not death.
Tina Packer, if I may say, you caught me off guard just now. You have some profound feeling about this.
I do have profound feeling about
it. I'm so sorry to say we just have a minute to go. Why the tears?
Oh, it was because I was thinking of the trial that's going on in Boston right now and how it's so about, you know, revenge. Why they did it was to do with revenge. What we're going to do is to do with revenge. And how can we get out of it, you know? And I don't think revenge ever, ever solves anything. And I think Shakespeare thought that too. So it just hit me that we're sitting here, we're waiting for that verdict. And you know, feels Shakespeare keeps on coming down the centuries.
Hmm. Well, Tina Packer, she is the founding artistic director of Shakespeare and Company, author of Women of Will, Following the Feminine in Shakespeare's Plays. She'll be speaking at Suffolk University's Modern Theatre next month. There's more information at our website, radioboston.org. And if I may say, Tina Packer, you are also a treasure. Thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you.
Stay with us. There's a lot more ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.